Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you. I love it. San Francisco, how you guys doing tonight? I'm so excited. What a lovely introduction. I always, when she said it's her last one, I didn't take that too personally or anything. It's like everything was great, but this one, I'm done. But listen, I'm really excited to speak with you this evening. You know, there are lots of fun things that we can do. As far as cooking and having a great time and talking about food and recipes. But then sometimes you want to kind of feed your soul and feed your mind and really talk about bigger, more philosophical topics with food, because it's the one thing that really ignites and connects all of us on a daily basis. And I think it's a very deep subject matter, and I think it's something we can always have a good time with. We are going to have a very in-depth, fun conversation tonight with an esteemed panel of professionals in the food space that I really admire. I think the people that we're going to have tonight are the best and the brightest in the food space, and people that are doing very innovative things that I hope you find very interesting. We're going to spend about 70 minutes tonight together. I'm going to have 10 questions. That's it. Right, so we're going to dive into 10 topics, and we're going to have a good time with it. We're going to talk about the future of food. We're going to talk about the problems that we have with our food pipeline. We're going to talk about creative solutions around solving these issues, as well as technological advances, new business models, which I think is very interesting, and perhaps what the kitchen of the future will look like. I think that's pretty cool. You guys ready to have a good time tonight? Fantastic. So my guests this evening are on the cutting edge of big ideas, and we've got a lot of really fun subject matter that we'd love to share with you tonight. And I want to start with my first guest, the lovely Megan Miller. If she can come on up, and she is the co-founder of Bitty Foods. Everybody say hi to Megan. Now the word bitty is a little bit misleading, because the company's mission is actually huge. Megan wants to help alleviate the stress on the global food system and help feed billions of people with edible insects. She was named one of Entrepreneur Magazine's 100 Brilliant Companies of 2014, and she's had accolades in New York Times, Elle, Vogue, Vice, Outside, Men's Health, Food & Wine. And if you want to look it up, she has a very impeccable TEDx talk that's online, which is really, really interesting about the subject matter. Please give a round of applause for Megan Miller. Right. Thank you. I'm glad you're here tonight.
Thank you.
My next guest, Adam Zabar. Adam is the co-founder and CEO of Sunbasket. And Sunbasket is a new startup right here in the Bay Area that offers organic meal kit delivery. Adam, how are you? Welcome to the forum tonight. And the meal kit delivery space, I think, is really, really interesting, right, on a lot of levels. Because I think as a restaurateur, like the restaurant industry, the model itself is kind of under attack from a couple of different directions, and we can be happy to kind of get explain more about that. But the business model is becoming harder and harder for a business to actually make money in the restaurant space, in the traditional restaurant space. So I think what Adam is bringing to the table is even more interesting, because it's a restaurant experience at home that you can participate in. Because so you get to feel like a chef and cook something, but it's not, you don't have to go shop. It's more like dump and stir and not shopping and chopping, which I think is incredible. Interesting, and his business is growing 17% a week. Isn't that amazing, right? And he's on his way to disrupting the $600 billion grocery store market, and he's one of the brightest people I've had a privilege of talking to in this past year. And he wants to become the farmer's market of the sky. Isn't that cool? Everybody say hi to Adam Zabar. Now, in the middle of the panel, I'm trying to do a boy-girl. We have a very good friend of mine, and I've had a privilege of working with Janet Hayes, who's the president of Williams-Sonoma. Everybody say hi to Janet. Fascinating, incredible leader. Janet Hayes is in charge of a publicly traded company that was founded in 1956 by the visionary retailer Chuck Williams. And currently, and this just came out today, I'm very proud of you, by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
Currently named the top company in California for women's leadership. It just came out today in Fortune magazine. Congratulations. It's an incredible company to work with and work for. I'm thrilled to call her not only a colleague but also an incredible leader. She oversees 248 stores worldwide. and she is the anchor of a multi-billion dollar kitchen lifestyle brand. Please give a warm round of applause for Janet Hayes. My next guest is a filmmaker. Douglas Gayton is a filmmaker and an artist based in Petaluma, California. He's kind of a rebel rouser. You guys will like him a lot. He's the co-founder of the Lexicon of Sustainability. Hello, brother. How are you? Welcome. Douglas Gayton, everybody. All right. So,
do you want your water?
So quickly, so the Lexicon of Sustainability was founded in 2009, and it's basically a consultancy for companies who really want to make their company sustainable, because sometimes when a company gets started, they don't really know how they can make themselves more sustainable, and Douglas is an expert at it. And he's shown a lot of companies how to become more sustainable in food, water, energy, and he has organized a team to help him do that. Passionate researchers, artists, scientists, filmmakers, and sustainability experts to help them become more sustainable and transparent. And he's also an incredible filmmaker and a photographer. Please give a warm round of applause for Douglas Gayton. Yeah. And last but not least, Dr. Laura Schimmick. She's the senior portfolio director and food scientist for IDEO, which is an award-winning design firm that takes... everybody give Dr. Laura Schimmick a round of applause. Oh, welcome.
Thank you. All right.
She's an award-winning design firm. IDEO itself is an incredible firm. They've designed a lot of amazing things. Even they designed the mouse, designed a lot of incredible stuff. We'll get to that in a second. But she's a food scientist. So I think it's a very interesting approach on food, and she has helped a lot of companies really kind of put their thought process into action by creating some very fantastic projects. And ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be our panel tonight for the future of food. You guys ready? Cool. Okay. So what we're gonna do tonight? So I'm gonna grab two of my panelists, and we're gonna kind of jump into some conversations, and we're gonna start off with Megan and Douglas, right? You guys can spar off for a second. This should be kind of fun. So this is now sustainability, right? Now this has been described as like the crossover of three separate circles, kind of coming together with a center spot, right? And those three circles represent social, economic, and environmental, with the center of those three circles being the pure vision of what sustainability is, right? So it's three circles kind of coming together, and it was the easiest definition I can really explain to somebody what sustainability means anyway. But the question is I have for you two guys is, like, getting everybody in a sandbox to make sustainability work, is it possible? Is sustainability actually possible?
I guess ultimately it depends upon how you define it. For example, if I was given that Venn diagram of those three circles, I would add spirituality to that probably. And then if I still thought that the person was slightly confounded by that description of that diagram, I would explain to them that sustainability really is a series of activities, a series of behavior modifications, a series of intentional acts that all will lead to lowering the amount of carbon in our atmosphere. It is the toolbox that we can use on this planet to confront climate change. When people talk about climate change, they get very vague about how you would solve climate change. They talk about carbon debts and carbon trading, but it's gonna take a series, it's not gonna be one switch that's turned. It's gonna be a series of dedicated activities, and usually those fall under the definition of what people think of when they think about sustainability.
Megan, how about you? Is it possible?
I mean, I think that it's an imperative, actually. It's sort of like saying, you know, you've got the social aspect, the economic aspect, and the environmental aspect. That's pretty much the whole system. And sustainability basically means the ability to last for a long time. So if we're saying that sustainability isn't possible, we're basically saying that the human race is not going to last, and that our social and economic and environmental systems don't have any hope.
Well, I wish it were easier than that in a way, or I feel like we would have had it by now, but it doesn't. Not everybody wants the same thing, especially when you start throwing dollars into the mix of it, because some companies don't really want everybody to be sustainable. They want them to get kind of hooked with one idea and one food source and one pipeline that's a little mysterious, and some people don't want it, right? But how do you really get everybody in the sandbox to really kind of make it happen? I think that's a really interesting topic.
Well, you know, if you have a system that's based upon disposability of material assets, then you are creating a condition where you will never be able to maintain yourself as a civilization. The interesting thing about us as people is that We are the first generation to actually come to grips that we're living in a world of finite resources. Up until this generation, people didn't really think about how many forests were left to cut down or if there was going to be enough land to raise cows so that we could service all of our McDonald's in the world. We're really the first generation that's confronting the fact that we have those limited resources. And so we also are confronting the fact that we basically live in a disposable society. So people are really beginning to rethink how things are made, how things are used, and where things come from. You know, I wouldn't say that sustainability is making things that last. It's interesting. Our project is called the Lexicon of Sustainability because things begin with words, you know. And often I find that the words are very limiting to how we can define or express something. And for example, up until even 10 years ago in France, they didn't have the word sustainability. They had the term matière durable, durable materials. And it's not really about something being durable or lasting. We need to be a regenerative society. We need to be creating abundance so that there's more than what we had for future generations. It's not just enough that we use up just what we consumed, because we've already consumed too much. We have to put something back. We have to bring our environment back into balance and our natural resources back into balance, be greater stewards of our water and our land. And that's really for us as a project what sustainability is.
Right. Well, will we have to come to the edge of disaster in society for someone to really make that happen or that become legislative material? Like I feel like we'd have to come to the edge of disaster, which I feel like we're almost there anyway. But you know, I don't know what that line is.
Well, what I meant when I said that it was an imperative is basically that we are going to reach a point where the global population outstrips our resources.
I think we've already done that.
Yeah, and it's not going to get better. In the next 2050, they're saying we're going to have about 11 billion people on the planet, up from 7 billion right now. And so we've got to come up with sustainable solutions for feeding all of these people and, you know, not destroying the earth in the process. And the problem with getting everybody in the sandbox is a matter of Maslow's hierarchy, right? Like, if you've got your basic needs met, you can start to think about the needs of others. But if you're just struggling to get food on the table, the first thing you're worried about is your family and your kids, and you aren't necessarily motivated to think beyond that unless the circumstances are so dire that you have to.
Right, and some of it may have to do with, I guess, developed versus non-developed world. I mean, one of the interesting things with our service is we decided that we were going to allow people to send their boxes back to us, right? We have a shipped home delivery service. There's a lot of material in the box. And the question was, well, it felt bad just to have people throw it out. And we have 70% of people who send it back. We actually thought about, well, should we continue this program? It costs us money. And we were told by our customers, if you discontinue it, we'll cancel. So part of getting people, I think, into the sandbox is they're already there. And I guess to your point, Megan, it depends on where you are, right? If you're struggling to survive it, you're at the bottom of the stack of Maslow's hierarchy, well, that's not what you're thinking. And when you visit developing countries, you feel a lot of that tension between, you know, how well the environment is being preserved, and then on the other side, how do you just actually serve human needs? But I definitely feel like where we are in kind of a more fortunate situation, now consumers are demanding it. They're voting their dollars.
So we talked about social, we talked about environmental, but it always feels like it's the economic thing that somebody can have a tendency to have more power over somebody else than the other, where they could you know, like flip your switch off if they wanted to, right, in a way. And that's where I feel like it would have to become come down to, you know, law and legislation that would require a model of sustainability for it to ever particularly happen. And then where does capitalism fall into that?
I mean, I think what you're hitting on, Tyler, is there's a real challenge to create urgency around this. So people are aware to some degree, but how do we create urgency for people to act on this? And maybe that urgency is implicit with some economics or some other factor, but there really needs to be something that gets this top of mind to people that it has to happen now so we don't get to that point that you mentioned, which is that ultimate disaster.
Yeah,
area.
You know, they look at behavior change always in two ways. One, you can offer incentives economically to incentivize people to do the right thing. But, for example, as we're seeing in agriculture, sometimes you simply have to introduce regulations because sometimes in agriculture, it's such a competitive industry that they're competing against each other. So if one person was to be more of a land or water steward, he would be put at a disadvantage to other people in the marketplace. So what we're seeing, and it's obviously very unpopular, but you know, there is a place for regulation if it can help introduce principles that are sustainable in a sense, but really, really have an impact on increasing water quality and provoking actions that increase land and water stewardship. So it's really a role of incentivizing to force behavior change, but also in some cases, actual regulation.
So really, green jobs are necessary to make this happen. You have to create the economy around that for that to actually be, like, there has to be a carrot there somewhere or another, right? I mean, for big change to happen. Like, we all can do a little part on an everyday level, and that stacks up, sure. But then how do you get back from the other direction, where it sort of is there and available for you? Like your consumer products that you buy on a daily basis, like, if those were, there was a veil of transparency that everybody can sort of see through and know exactly where things come from, and people lived up to that particular standard, that to me feels like...
But, you know, it's interesting, you know, like you mentioned about that veil, you know, we see time and time again that when consumers are given visibility into how food is made, when they're given greater transparency into what the ingredients are, they will always opt to buy a food that's made that's closely aligned with their values, mm-hmm. even if it costs more. And what's really powerful about that is that if consumers are allowed, given a window into how their food system works or what the ingredients are in food, mm-hmm. they actually can topple industries. And I can give you two very quick examples. RBST, which is a growth hormone that was prevalent in the dairy industry, when consumers began to realize that there was a growth hormone in their milk, they actually opted to not have a growth hormone in their milk, and as a result of that, that company that made that hormone had to sell it off. The same thing could be said for the cage-free egg. When consumers learned that the bulk of their poultry were raised in these battery cages, they opted to buy poultry and buy eggs that didn't come from them. And so when consumers are given visibility, when they understand how the food system works, when they're given a chance to buy things according to their values, they shift the food system.
One of the things to consider, though, is that there's a certain point at which the price becomes untenable. So one of the things we talk about a lot at Bitty Foods is how the price of meat is going up, and economists are saying that in the next 30 years, beef is going to be priced like caviar. If it's going to become a luxury that is scarce, that we eat for special occasions.
I mean,
yeah.
Like a $60 8-ounce filet mignon is coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we're going to have to eat less just because it's going to be a luxury food that we can't afford to eat all of the time. And that's basically the impetus for this whole alternative protein movement, of which Bitty Foods is a part, where we're trying to find other solutions for things that can augment the diet so that people aren't so reliant on meat.
All right, so let's jump into that for a second, because I think crickets are interesting. I've known Megan, I guess, about 3 years now. And and to me, like, when we start working on an idea together, and really start taking this cricket flour and start to kind of do some fun stuff with it, you have to suspend this sort of fear factory kind of vibe, right? and really start to understand, like, you're doing this for a purpose. And why don't you dive into some of the stats for a second? Because this to me is super fascinating. When you understand, when you can make a choice like a cage-free egg or hormone-free milk, when you can make a decision, alternative protein, because we need that nutrient, right? But you can get it from another direction. Crickets stop tasting like crickets, and they start tasting like toast.
Yeah.
You know? They really do. You start changing your ideas about that. Go ahead,
yeah.
Talk for a second.
Well, we talk a lot about the differences in water usage, because to me, the water and land usage difference between traditional livestock and crickets, which we call micro livestock, which is kind of cute.
I like that.
It's huge. It's like you can grow like 15,000 crickets in a like 3-foot square box, and they like it. They're not being overcrowded and tortured. They huddle together because they're, you know, that's how they like to cluster. And they use so much less water. To grow a cow, to grow 1 pound of beef, it takes about 2,500 gallons of water. And to grow a pound of soybeans, which we think, you know, plant proteins are going to necessarily be better, that's about 250 gallons of water still. One pound of cricket protein, 1 gallon of water. So you're looking at like a really tremendous difference when it comes to places that are susceptible to drought, like California, and coming up with protein solutions that aren't so reliant on having a large amount of land to grow things or to graze animals, and having the water to nourish them.
Crickets, micro livestock. I love that. You heard it first. All right, this is a question for Janet and Lauren. Now, when you're developing a food product, right, for either through IDEO or for Williams-Sonoma, how much work goes into the sustainability of the raw materials? Is it the first decision or is it the second decision?
Mm-hmm. So I can jump in and say when we are developing products, the first thing we do is we start with people. We always start with understanding what they're thinking, how they're feeling, you know, what they're saying. We watch what they're doing. We spend time with them. And so really designing to those needs is the first place we start. We then layer on technical feasibility and business viability. And sustainability is implicit in all of those because it's not just about the amount of material that's in that product. It's about the behaviors that surround it. We're always looking at the journey of a product and a person. What are they doing? How are they interacting? At the end, what's the end life experience of that? Are they throwing it away or are they composting it? And I think sustainability is much bigger than just materials itself. We're designing for sustainable behaviors, and implicit in that is people plus technology. So it's not materials alone.
Yeah, unlike, much like what Lauren said at Williams-Sonoma, we always listen to our customer first. We have for 60 years, and it's intrinsic to what we do. And when the customer is telling us things are changing, we're pretty good at listening. I think a good example of that is our agrarian line that we came out with 3 years ago. You know, we were hearing from our customer, not only do they want to know where their food is coming from, but they actually want to be where it's coming from. And we brought out a whole line of chicken coops and planters and kind of empowered our customer to actually have their own food, grow their own food. And it's interesting how quickly it took with our customer who we thought was, you know, not this person, not this farmer, not this agrarian, but actually it was interesting not only the insight that they gave us, but where it took off was mostly in urban spaces, actually. Mm-hmm. And when after people got the product, after our customers got the product, they came back to us for more inspiration about, okay, now what do I do? And I actually got letters saying, I have too many eggs. I have too many eggs. I don't know what to do with them. And we started putting photographs actually in our catalog where we would show the chicken coops and then show inspirational recipes of what to do with it.
That's cool.
And I remember our sales took off threefold when we actually took the planters that we were selling and put this big, beautiful plate of salad right next to it. So I think, you know, do we think about sustainability? Yes, we do. But we listen to our customer, and you have to be so aware. It's how they want to do it. They want to be inspired. I think there's a lot of pressure for our customer to be sustainable, and they don't know how yet, and they don't know what it means. And if we can inspire them so that their behavior turns to sustainability almost without them even being conscious about it, honestly, is a really great place for Williams-Sonoma to play. We do, and in the food that we carry, because we provide a very curated and edited experience, we do talk a lot to our food vendors about local. You know, how are you supporting your own local community? And I mean, we have some really beautiful examples of some incredible food that we sell. One of them is a U.S. Salt vendor called Ben Jacobson, if anyone wants to.
Fantastic.
Unbelievable.
I love the salt. It's great.
Unbelievable, yeah. Story. So inspiring. U.S. salt manufacturer up in Portland, right outside of Portland, Oregon. Doing everything, I think, right, from how he's, you know, completely sustainable process for how the salt has come about. And then we are working with a honey company called Bee Local.
I love Bee Local.
Which is incredible. And they are inspiring us to, they actually want to put hives on some of the top of our stores in urban areas and let us drop the honey down into our stores. So, I mean, great is that?
And the Bee Local story is really interesting as well. And you should look him up on Instagram and Twitter because he's very kind of prolific in social media. So he has a sort of partnership with the community, right?
Yeah.
So it's based out of Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. and he has hives all over Portland, so you can adopt a beehive. So it's sort of a win-win situation where the bees will pollinate all of your plants or fruit trees, mm-hmm. or you just feel like you're doing the right thing, having like bee pets in a way, right? And then and then he'll come and manage the whole thing.
He'll manage
and
the
he takes
thing.
The honey. He gives you a little bit of the honey. But then he ends up, he's created a consumer product out of that, which I think is fascinating. And what's really interesting, if you see like the gradation of color between the honeys in different neighborhoods in Portland, right? It goes from mahogany dark to like champagne, you know, clear. And they're all just honeys and from the same community. And I think it's super interesting.
Beautiful
product. So this is why I think it's really great. It's the reason I like your company so much, because like they support the little guy. Mm-hmm. You always have and you always will. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about that. So sustainability is kind of coming like from these little small partners, those small people that are creating great products locally. And with that, they don't really create a lot of mess along the way.
No, they don't. And then there's one other product that I love that, again, is Portland-based, which I love that city. It's such a fantastic food city and so many innovative, incredible, talented people there. Marshall's Hot Sauce, right? She has this incredible hot sauce. And she will only use the vegetables that she finds at her local market. And she is at her local farmer's market. And she has actually influenced the farmers to start growing what she needs for her sauce. Because she won't take anything. She won't take anything outside of her local farmers market to make this product. So there's some really beautiful stories that we then use, we hope to inspire our customer that, you know, automatically then turns them into thinking more local.
Now, what about packaging, right? So I think that, like, to me, like, packaging can either be really smart and just enough, or sometimes I get bummed out if I buy something and it's just got tons of excess packaging, and I feel like I'm just kind of creating garbage when we do that. When we design goods, products and stuff like that, I try to make the packaging as minimal as possible. Who's making some great packaging? You guys are doing some good packaging.
Well, right? So one of the interesting things, so, you know, we ship groceries, right, in essence, and we have to keep those cold for up to 2 days, so 60 hours. And so the question was, well, how are we going to do that? And nobody in the company wanted to use styrofoam, right? Like, that was like, if there was one thing that would like get people starting to get antsy and get argumentative, was saying, oh, well, we're going to do that because that's how people did it. And then we found a company, and Doug and I were talking about this, that does recycled blue jean. So it turns out there's a lot of recycled blue jean fiber. They actually, they take that, they put it in our packaging insulation, and then we tested sort of the standard versus the recycled blue jeans, and it was one of those win-wins where actually it holds up better. And so we had the best tests.
Why? Because of cotton fiber? Like, well, why is it better?
I actually can't tell you the science behind it, but I can tell you that we actually did measurements. So we literally would take our food, and we would put each one in a different type of box. So we had everything from, you know, one that was your styrofoam to the other one that had recycled blue jeans to two or three other technologies. It beat the other ones hands down. And then the other thing, though, we felt like, well, we still want to bring it back to us so that we can reuse it more than once. Because what we heard from customers is like, hey, that's great, but it's still a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so there's some part of kind of the sustainability piece, I think, that is purely the impact on resources. And there's another part that's just psychological. Like, it sucks throwing out a bunch of stuff, right? People want to feel that there's either it's being actively reused and regenerated, or they want to feel that, you know, it's being disposed of in a way that actually is kind to the earth. So that's been something that, and I think we're just starting. I think we're actually working on a 2.0 solution from a former IDEO designer. So something that we feel like we definitely haven't gotten right yet, but we're basically going in the right direction.
I think packaging is really, you know, there's a long runway to be able to take already used goods and products and turn them into something else, like recycled plastics and things like that. I mean, be able to turn them into like water bottles you can eat. I mean, I think that to me is like one of the really like great frontier in food and food science, to be able to think through products that just sort of go disappear, like actually create no garbage whatsoever.
I think that there's an interesting new frontier that we're going to see around smart packaging. So not just recyclable or compostable, but packaging that can tell you when your food is safe to eat or when it's about to expire, because I think one of the pieces of sustainability in food is food waste, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just the packaging and material, but people throwing out food because it's past the expiration date, things like that, and it feels like that's the next generation of packaging that's smart to tell us, you know, when to eat this food or how to keep this food.
Or packaging you so straight in the ground because it's compostable and biodegradable, right?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, that's a whole movement in the natural food space. They've actually created a coalition called OSC2. Which is entirely focused on creating open source solutions to create compostable packaging. And they're releasing their first products in 2016.
Who is it again? I'm sorry?
It's called OSC2.
Okay.
Open Source Compostable Consortium. And I find them to be very, very, like, very interesting group of people because they realize that consumers buy products because their products because of the values that are inherent in that product and what went into it, but nobody ever thinks about what that product came in. And 2015 might have been the year that people talked about food waste, and I would argue that maybe 2016 will be the year people talk about packaging waste. And I think it's going to be a really big topic in the coming year.
And well, this is going to kind of tip into this next question, which I think is really interesting about the new emerging restaurant model, which I think is just food trucks 2.0, to be perfectly honest with you. And this is for Janet and Adam both. So both Sunbasket and Williams-Sonoma are getting to the home meal replacement. Janet, you guys do a fabulous job around creating holiday meals and around like important times of the year. Mm-hmm. And Adam, that's your whole business model. How much is that business is growing? And then if we could kind of jump into like the benefits, big and small, of letting somebody else do the hard work.
Start. Yeah, so Williams-Sonoma has this kind of quietly stealth business. It's online only, of developing and delivering food to your home that you literally either just have to put in the oven or put in the refrigerator. And it's not like what Adam's doing of the pieces and then you cook it together. It's already, you know, mostly cooked when you get there. We are doing full meals around Thanksgiving, so you could order your full Thanksgiving meal from us, the turkey, the stuffing, the gravy, the mashed potatoes, everything. It is growing exponentially, and I think it is, again, when we listen to our customer, who, by the way, loves to cook. Our customer loves to cook. Mm-hmm. They're interested in it, but they don't always have time. And time is a big factor in why I think this is taking off. And it's not about having the perfect meal with the perfect flavor. That's not what I hear, that why these customers are doing that. Perfect has kind of gone away. What it is about being able to come into your holiday and actually spend time with the people who are in your home instead of doing all the prep. Or they're going to visit their daughter, and their daughter might not know how to cook yet, so they'll send the meal down there. But for us, it is, you know, we believe so much in giving a great experience, and the best feedback I get is from these customers that have ordered these full meals in for all different kind of occasions, the holiday occasions or a bereavement or anything. But the idea that we are saving people time and still letting them gather and be with each other is what we really love.
So tell me how much that's growing. Like with a traditional, you know, business model of you know, housewares, mm-hmm. and the experiential cooking and equipment to be able to kind of pull that experience off. And now you're selling not selling just the equipment, but also the experience. What are the percentage of sales? Because I think it's an emerging space that it's just north of a grocery store and just south of a restaurant, and I think people like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, our, as you said, we focus mostly around the holidays right now, and that business is enormous for us. But we are seeing an everyday component around celebrations or, again, time-starved people. I mean, one of the easiest things we do is deliver a birthday cake into someone's home. I mean, think about, you're trying to pull together a birthday party and pull the whole thing together.
Can
and
you
the
put
last
somebody's
thing
name
you
on
need
it?
Is even, what?
Can you put somebody's name on it?
Yes. Yeah, you can personalize cookies, you can personalize cakes, you can, you know, you're trying to pull together the whole part. How about if that cake just shows up? You didn't have to run out and get it.
That's
so
cool.
I mean, it's it's time. It's important. It's growing. It's a big part of our future.
Like, and if you could you throw out some numbers? Like what are you doing in sales in that particular category?
I cannot throw out any numbers. But I like that you're trying.
I know that. To me, I just think the category, because like it's like the reason I think this is interesting for people, because it's like where food trucks just seem to pop up out of nowhere,
yeah.
Right? This past September, the sixth season of the Great Food Truck Race aired. And it was funny because a couple articles started to pop up that the Great Food Truck Race sort of started the food truck movement. And I don't think we necessarily did it as much as we were in the right place at the right time and kind of gassed the industry to turn into something great. And I think that the restaurant industry, the way it exists with, you know, with rents becoming so incredibly expensive and raw goods becoming even more expensive and labor to make that magic happen becoming even more expensive, there's actually little money to be made in the restaurant business pushing forward. Like, so I think something that's kind of popping up is this magical thing in between,
yeah,
where you get this experience kind of sent to your house where you can participate in it. And I think there's some really great ecological, environmental benefits to all that stuff too. And I think you guys are jumping that into Sunbasket, right?
Right. So I mean, so I guess to your question of kind of how big is the market? Well, 80% of Americans cook 3 to 5 times a week. If you look at those people, over 50% of people say that they have a strong interest in this type of concept, meal kit delivery. Less than 1% have tried. But when you look at our service, Blue Apron, Plated, HelloFresh, I mean, these models are racing. We went from just 5 people on my team 5 months ago to 150. We went from having a 5,000 square foot facility to over a 70,000 square foot facility. I mean, this is moving rapidly fast, and this isn't just tech-fueled dollars. This is demand-driven, right? I've been in both types of startups, and I think it comes back.
This is
back,
not just sort of blind valuation.
Right.
These are sales.
Right. We're growing super, super fast, and the balance is obviously keeping quality, right? So an anecdotal story is I met Don Barnett, who is the co-founder of Organic Grill, and he was kind of luminary in the space, and he said, hey, well, maybe I'll be your advisor. Then he watched our sales, and he said, I want to be on your board. And then he jumped on. Now he's my full-time COO. He left a $500 million company. And so you see, but back to, I guess, Janet's point, it's not just the business model. It fundamentally comes down to the service. And what people want, and, you know, we encapsulate all of it in our mission, is they want to make healthy cooking easy and delicious. So they want that time savings. But at the same time, they don't want to put junk on the table, right? Like, that's why models, you know, from some of the diet stuff never took off, right? Because frozen dinners, nobody wants to eat that. So
how many people have had a home meal delivered to your house? Like Munchery or Blue Apron? A lot. The lights are really bright up here. I can't really see. But I see a lot of hands coming up. Do you guys dig that? It's good. You love it, right? Because I think people like to cook at home, but I think going to the grocery store, once you really start looking into the stats, right? I think the grocery store model is busted. I think it's broken. I think it's so wasteful. 40% of everything that you buy at the grocery store ends up in the garbage can, right? I mean, just think about right now. Think about what's in your vegetable crisper. Is it fresh or is it ready for the garbage can? I mean, really think about it, right? So when people go to the grocery store, they shop out of an impulsivity because something looks really kind of fresh, but they get home and either they have something, they know exactly what they're going to do with it, or they have the intention to do something with it, but then 60% of the time they do and 40% of the time they don't. So that 40% of the time that gets up in the garbage can, right, where the stuff that shows up at your house, it's all prepped for you, right? So if this company can get 4 portions out of 1 bunch of parsley, right, and you just get the 1/4 cup or 2 tablespoons that you need for that particular recipe, and they can use more of it, and you can use exactly what you need, and nothing goes in the garbage can. This is the wave of the future, to be really honest with you, right? So, kind of voting with your dollars, I know it sort of sounds sort of silly in a way, but I think we can all be responsible by taking a look at these situations that are like so environmentally friendly and fun at the same time. And so it's really about who can produce the best service, right? So I want to jump into waste for a second, because I think
Go ahead. Because I think it's really interesting. We're here in the Bay Area, and we see these companies. Right now I have 5 apps on my phone that I could press right now and get, you know, an awesome meal in 2 to 3 minutes. But it's actually really spreading, just like you're saying. There's more than 50 companies across the U.S., and they're delivering food directly to you, and not just in major cities, in places like Overland Park, Kansas, or Milwaukee, or Columbus, Ohio. So it's really taking off. And I think you're right, it's going to absolutely disrupt the model, not just about how we get food to us, but how we understand the story of food, how we're interacting with products, because it's not on a shelf anymore in a shelf set.
It's not.
On an iPhone, or it's on a computer.
There's no customer-facing version of the store. Right? It's just virtual, right? So instead of having this, you know, corner of Maine and Maine expensive 80,000 square foot retail space, you guys have got a really sexy location in South San Francisco.
Yeah. But I would say this. I actually don't think grocery stores are bad, and I actually don't think they've broken. I just don't think that they've evolved to what we need. And I think that the home delivery is incredible. Anything that inspires people to cook and they can eat at home where it's healthy for them, I'm all for. But what hasn't evolved in the grocery store is the service model. If you were standing in the produce department, right, telling everybody what to buy and giving them recipes,
like a concierge, right? Like,
you would
oh,
love
broccoli.
It,
let me
right?
tell you about
it's
the broccoli.
Everyone's still standing at the register waiting to check you out. There's actually nobody standing in the grocery store helping you choose, which I think is probably the biggest opportunity.
And it's a profitability model, right? Because like gigantic grocery store, it's a $600 billion industry, the grocery store industry. It's massive. But they produce a 1% to 4% profit model on the bottom line. It gets sucked into like God knows where, but it's not. They're not producing. And in my opinion, I think you're absolutely right. Is like who can produce the better customer experience? That's what I'm into, right?
And turn it into the center of the community. Right. I will tell you, on Halloween, I ran from the mall, grabbing something at the mall, to running into my Whole Foods. Okay, the mall. I mean, unfortunately, really quiet. Okay, I couldn't move in my grocery store. I couldn't move, and I actually stopped and thought, so this is where everybody is. Everybody is in the grocery store. Actually, it's the biggest opportunity to become the center of the community. We can't make things can't go away where people can gather and learn from each other. It doesn't all have to be online. It can be where you're touching the food or looking at the food, but I think the grocery store model has to evolve. It has to actually think of itself as a center of a community that actually can be brave enough to connect you to the best farmers.
Would Williams-Sonoma ever become a hybrid live food market like that?
We could.
I mean, so this is really interesting because you're in a very incredibly powerful situation where you could open up a couple of retail stores just as a goof at a test to figure out if something else would really stick. But like to me, like there's a would you guys agree with me that the grocery stores it's not fun? You know what I mean? This past Sunday morning, in our house, my 7-year-old daughter Dorothy, she thinks her dad makes some pretty good pancakes, and I would agree. I think my pancakes are pretty spot on, but if we don't have, I'm not a braggy kind of guy, but I think they're pretty good. But we have to have buttermilk in the house to really kind of make that work. And I've tried to make it with whole milk or heavy cream or even coconut milk, whatever you got laying around. It doesn't work. So this past Sunday, she was like, Daddy, she wakes me up out of bed, and with one eye open, she goes, it's Pancake Sunday. And I'm like, all right. So we get up, go to the grocery store down the street, right? And we were also having friends over for dinner. I just made a shopping thing out of it, right? And so to me, walking through this maze of 250,000 SKUs, right, in a grocery store, I'm making that number up. I don't know how many, but it sits a lot, right? But I know how to snap this stuff together, but I can't imagine somebody who doesn't cook professionally be able to navigate a grocery store and know that the salmon in this aisle goes with the broccoli on that aisle and then this other sauce on this aisle. I know that stuff, but it must be so frustrating to go to the grocery store. I think it's the reason people can't really cook. I think it's the biggest area for innovation that we exist, and you could do so much. Would you guys agree?
I totally agree.
You could
agree.
Do so much for the environment, right? Thank you very much. Thank you. You could do so much for the environment, right? I was fishing for that one. You could do so much for the environment, but you could also really reintroduce this whole new system, and let's say it's delivery, right? Let's say it's delivery, but you could deliver kits. So anyway, I think we're all kind of getting to the really good stuff that I actually think bring the product and the user, you guys, us, closer together, not farther apart. We got to take the middleman out as much as possible.
I don't want to be a curmudgeon.
But?
Sure.
But I really can't sit up here and be down with meals delivered to people's homes and people not having any time to cook anything.
No, I'm not saying they don't. I'm not saying they don't have time to cook. I'm saying they don't have time to go shopping.
We're walking around the problem.
Yeah.
And we are. It's like we're treating the results of the problem instead of just treating the problem. The problem is that people don't know how to cook because they don't understand what food is. You know, how many times have I actually seen a kid pull a carrot out of the ground and be like, what's this dirt stuck on this carrot? Because they complete disconnect of where food comes from and what to do with it. So I just can't sit up here. I just have to simply say that I'm of the camp of people that think that we need to put all of our energy and effort into teaching people what food is and getting people back into a more integral relationship with whole food.
All right. So Great. I I don't want to sit up here and be a curmudgeon or anything, but like, but to me, I think we can create a better relationship, right? I think we can create a closer relationship with a new model of getting it from you to me. Like in marketing, they call it closing the impulse gap, right? And I think in the systems that we have, there's a grand canyon of space between like me shopping, and yes, I can get my hands on it, but I have no idea where it came from. I have no idea like really what to do with it necessarily. So I think there's a lot of ways. Let's just talk about waste for a second. I got a good question for Douglas and Lauren. So an article written in the Washington Post last year, it states that Americans throw out more food than plastic, paper, metal, and glass combined, right? 40% to be exact, 35 million tons of food, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, were thrown out last year, right? What can we do to make sure, this is a really good sort of segue into what you're just talking about, what can we do to make sure our farmers' hard work doesn't end up in the garbage can? Because like that's a problem I think we can solve with this delivery thing.
So the steps. Food is grown. Food is harvested. Food is distributed. Food ends up in a retail operation. And then food is bought by somebody either at a restaurant or a consumer who buys and puts it in their refrigerator. So those are the steps and the journey of food from the seed to the plate where something can go wrong in the sense that something doesn't get eaten. So it's gross inefficiencies literally at every single point in that system. It's a system of things that are grown and sometimes don't come to market because of prices. Sometimes it's cheaper just to leave it literally in the field. It's a system of inefficiencies in terms of the distribution of that food from where it's grown to where it goes to the store, and also in stores like themselves. I mean, if you go to a Whole Foods, and I'm certainly not slamming Whole Foods, attempts to have a local face on its grocery stores, 95% of the produce comes from Mexico. That came in a truck. You know, the largest amount of food waste in all of North America is at the border at Juarez and El Paso. Somebody should make a film about it. I wish we were making a film about it. Because it's where film comes across the border and ag inspectors dump it. Because we have all these rules about ugly fruit and ugly produce that's perfectly fine to eat. And we don't deal with those inefficiencies in that distribution chain. We don't take that food that isn't maybe not useful for human consumption and then divert it so that it has another stream where it finds a secondary use. It's a very inefficient system. People are only waking up to that fact now. I mean, you brought up this really great point. If there was packaging on food, just like you have on a battery that tells you whether the battery's good or not, and if we had that on food, it'd be very, very efficient because consumers would know.
Yeah, I mean, I want to take us to your kitchen. Like, how many people have gone shopping on a Sunday and planned their meals, and by Thursday night, you've totally changed plans, you're too tired to cook, and then by Friday you realize, oh, that chicken I bought is actually expired.
Right.
So I think there's so much possible innovation in the kitchen, in packaging, that can actually give us feedback along the way to tell us how to interpret those best by dates, how to know when food is truly expired, mm-hmm. and when it needs to be composted versus consumed. I also think that's where some of this direct food delivery comes into play. I mean, it's easy to be healthy when you're a planner. It's not so easy to make spontaneously healthy choices. And I think some of this direct food to delivery, it's actually not competing with the grocery store. It's actually competing with fast food. Mm-hmm. It's competing with other less healthy options. So being able to make spontaneously healthy choices throughout the week, actually I think will prevent some food waste of throwing away things that maybe have expired and actually allow people to have more healthy lifestyles.
Well, actually something that you said, Tyler, mm-hmm. before we came down tonight, you said one of the interesting things about his model is that if you're in a restaurant, you have to have everything there for everything that's on the menu sitting there in the kitchen, mm-hmm. whereas he knows in advance exactly what he's going to make, and so he dramatically reduces...
Exactly what they want.
He dramatically reduces the amount of food waste that would be produced because he's producing exactly what he knows in advance he's going to need.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so being able to actually choose in the moment a healthy choice that minimizes that excess of, mm-hmm. of product or minimizes that spoilage is going to be something that contributes to less food waste.
Can I speak up for crickets again? Doug, I think we need to build a cricket farm in El Paso because it turns out that...
See, now we're talking. This is great.
Yeah.
Yes,
synergies.
This is great. Yeah, I like that. It's good. Yeah.
Yeah, crickets can eat food waste.
Yeah.
And we're working with the farmers that are growing our crickets to make sure that they're they're eating waste stream foods as much as possible. So for instance, one of the farmers is using grains from a distillery that were spent brewer's grains. And, you know, you can also use the...
So we're talking about drunk crickets.
Yes. we don't have any data on that, but maybe. And then, you know, like the tops of vegetables that have been chopped up for making other products. Or they could eat, you know, any fruit and vegetable rejects.
That well, you know, two quick stories. One is I was in New York at the largest single distributor of wholesale food on the Eastern Seaboard. I won't say their name. And extraordinarily impressive facility. And they were showing me, these women are only cutting Brussels sprouts. These people are only slicing up celery slices. And it was this amazing chain of human productivity. It looked like something out of the Willy Wonka movie with everybody in, like, their little white lab coats. And I noticed all these people pushing all these bins around, and the bins was everything after they had cut it all up. And I said, what's in that bin? They said, oh, you know, yeah, it's not really part of anything that we sell. So I detached myself from these people, and I followed the bin. And the bin ended up in this big area they were just dumping. I'm like, where's that going? Like, well, we just take it to the dump. And I'm just like, this is extraordinary, the amount of food that's being wasted. Mm-hmm. Second quick story is up in British Columbia, talking about crickets.
So this is where our water's going, by the way. You know what I mean? Like, if you really think about how much water, like, we don't have in California, and then we end up throwing this because we water these plants, and then half of it goes in the garbage can. I mean, this is really upsetting.
I think if you were to take a farmer there and see how their product ends up, they would just cry. I mean, it's so sad. But, you know, in British Columbia, one of the solutions they're trying to do with food waste is very similar to what you're doing, is they're taking food waste, and they're consolidating it, and they are feeding it to black soldier flies. Mm-hmm. The largest aquaculture industry in the world, I think you could argue, is in Canada, and the fish feed for these fish in these fish farms comes from the anchoveta, comes all the way from Peru. It's an extraordinarily absurd misuse of fish protein to feed another fish. But they're finding out they can actually feed them these black soldier fly larvae, which are super high in omega-3 and omega-6s. And the only thing that these larvae eat is food waste. So literally zero cost to this protein creating operation. We're going to see more and more stories like that as people look at alternate protein sources.
I love that. Okay, so I'm getting the number down here in the corner. So we're going to rapid fire these next couple of questions. We got 10 questions. I've only gotten through 5. This is for Megan and Adam. So as two young companies, I think this is where, you know, the idea of not having like a forward facing company, right? I think it's super interesting. So, as two young companies in the food space that do not plan on having a brick and mortar store, how do you see e-retail evolving? Like the idea of hitting a button on your phone and something showing up. How is that turning to like the new way people shop?
Well, for us, we started out as an e-commerce company before we even had any products, which is really weird. It came from the media attention that I got around the concept of eating crickets, and then people were like, yeah, I get it. Show me the cookies. And we were like, we don't
show
have
me the cookies.
So people started pre-ordering the products, and our e-commerce started that way. And I think...
those are the cookies?
Is yeah, that it? Actually.
Go ahead.
I was eating crickets earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah, brother.
You didn't even know.
Yeah, I mean, they
were
know.
Awesome.
Tastes like dark toast. That's right. It's a good cookie.
That's awesome. So for us, I think the biggest thing and the biggest evolution as we go forward is finding new ways of storytelling around products. Because we've gotten past the point where people just, you know, buy stuff in a vacuum. They want to know like the backstory of the product and the origins of their food and things like that. And especially if you don't have the opportunity to taste it, you need some compelling reason why to choose this thing over that thing on the internet. So we work a lot on storytelling.
Yeah, actually I was gonna echo the same thing, which is when you can't physically be in front of someone, storytelling is the most powerful thing on the web. Actually, Nicole, who's here, who's our photographer, if you look at our website, she takes stunning photos. And obviously the end reason why I think we're being highly successful is that the actual product, when we ship it to people love it, but we wouldn't even have gotten there if we hadn't had the storytelling. And kind of to Megan's point, it was really interesting when we asked people what healthy meant to them and how they shopped at the grocery store. They said, well, when I go and I look at that egg in the grocery store, I need to be able to tell myself a story. If I can picture the farm it came from,
right.
If I can picture the chicken being treated humanely, if I can imagine that journey to the store, and then it says the various things I want to hear, that it doesn't have GMOs or it doesn't have pesticides or antibiotics, then I feel like it's healthy. And so really, the number one thing that we try to do on our site is we try to tell stories. So we tell them through pictures. We have, in every single box, the first thing that happens when you open is there's a picture of the farmer of the week. And we tell that story and we tell that narrative. And I mean, actually, my company is stocked full of sort of ex-filmmakers that now live in the Bay Area that want to somehow tell stories and communicate the message of what we're doing. So ultimately, you have to have a great product, but definitely on the web, it starts with storytelling.
Now, Janet, I mean, with 60 years of experience, like creating catalogs with Williams-Sonoma, if there's anybody in the audience, and I feel like I'm asking this question for somebody here, what advice would you give a young food company that's making a thing, right? And then the idea of them having like a brick and mortar store, it just seems out of reach financially. But they can get that to a customer through an app or through an association. Like, what advice would you give them?
I mean, I think e-commerce is the future. You know, we have an incredibly strong e-commerce business at Williams-Sonoma along with our brick and mortar, and they can live together. And I think, more importantly, at the higher level, even with these two brilliant people, I think we don't use each other enough at all, honestly. Like, we should be dropping Sunbasket, into my customer. My customer should be your customer. We should share our customers. But then why not have cooking classes at the store that can help teach your customer how to make even a better meal,
right?
You don't even know if they're making a great meal with what
sure.
you sent them. Do we? I mean, right. But if they came in and learned the technique. Right.
I love all the people up here, but I thought it would be good to have a conversation anyway, right. Because like the idea of what you guys sell,
yeah.
right, and what you do, you really need each other, right?
We do.
Because
and,
like yeah. with this food kit, what are they going to cook it on and with, and what are they going to plate it up on, and what are they going to drink out of, and then I just think it's a really great synergy.
Yeah, right. I mean, your business is incredible. It helps what we do at Williams-Sonoma immensely, and to use each other so that the Williams-Sonoma store becomes a place where you learn how to cook. I mean, we love to teach. We've been teaching for a long time, and what you need to get that meal forward, we should just all be working together more. And, the most of the times when an online business comes to us, they're looking for a place for their customers to gather, right? And to gather and talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all online. It's easy to talk online, but really, this is a very local idea, and they should be using our stores to just even drop down and have a chat in the store.
I love it.
So I think we just need to use each other more, honestly.
Perfect. All right. So this just happened today when I was writing the questions up, and I just thought it was super interesting for Douglas and Lauren. Now, the Food and Drug Administration just approved today the first GM food animal, which is the Atlantic salmon. It's actually been approved by the FDA as an official food thing. And I just want to know your thoughts on it really quickly.
Sure, I'll start. So I'm an optimist. I think we have big problems in our food system right now. We have problems with obesity. We have problems with hunger. We have problems with resources. We've talked a lot about that in the environment and the way food is made. And so I think technology and innovation is going to be part of solving those problems. And I don't think we can throw out an entire category of technology without taking a hard look at how it might serve a greater good for some of these purposes. And I think there are some amazing, interesting startups that are using different technology, including genetic engineering, in service of a greater good. And I think the but here is we have to ask tough questions, we have to actually better anticipate unintended consequences, and we have to use two filters when we're looking at new technologies like genetic engineering. And those two filters are, first, people. Who is this impacting? And what are their needs? And then second, purpose. What is the purpose and intention behind this? Because I think technology can be used for a good purpose, but we need to be really conscious and really cautious and careful when we're doing that. So personally, I don't want to throw it all out, but I think we need to have better resources, better tools to better evaluate and make good choices, because we have big problems to solve.
I'm not personally opposed to GMOs, genetically modified organisms. And there are cases, for example, of the genetically modified papaya in Hawaii that over 25 years ago actually saved an entire industry in the Hawaiian Islands And we have a lot of data to show that it had negligible impacts environmentally, and it literally saved jobs, and it, as I said, it saved an entire industry. But there's a lot of, we're doing too much testing in the public of things that we would never do if it was for a kind of cosmetic or a kind of drug. There would be an entirely different system. To put things into the marketplace is it's very disturbing. And it's more disturbing because we already know how aquaculture works, ocean-based open net fisheries work, the tremendous environmental impacts that they have wherever they are, the degradation of wild species wherever they are. But this is known. It's not like something that we don't know yet. We know this wherever we see them, whether it's in the North Atlantic or whether we see them in British Columbia, we know the negative impact of aquaculture. It's so alarming that a people that might know more about salmon than all of us would be, for example, the Native Indians, who we spent time with up in British Columbia. The Nungis First Nations tribe has been had their fisheries almost wiped out and by all of the disease brought by these open net aquaculture fisheries there. And they did a very dramatic thing. They actually built the world's first on-land Atlantic farm, Atlantic salmon fish farm. So if they see firsthand the negative impacts of aquaculture on what it does to the environment and to wild species, then we should be learning from what they're doing. So my first thought would be, are they going to actually let that fish into a net in the Pacific Ocean, where it can get out?
It'll happen.
Of course it'll happen.
Yeah.
So therefore, what have we done? You know, it's like people who frack, who say, we're putting all these incredibly lethal chemicals below the water table. Like, what does that mean? I mean, the insanity of what we're doing, the inability to look at the externalized cost, the long tail of our actions, in many cases, things that we're not going to be able to undo. We're not going to be able to pull these chemicals out of the ground, you know? We're not going to be able to unbiologically contaminate species once that's happened. So I think it's incredibly irresponsible. And I think we're only at the beginning of this conversation. I don't think it's over.
Let's look at the other extreme thing. What Lauren was talking about, we're going to run out of food. I mean, we're running out of food. We're running out of fish. The ocean's almost fished out. Like, what do we have to eat?
Well, and I have to say, I don't think we should just do technology for technology's sake, and that's right. Where purpose-driven comes into play. And I think we're seeing a whole new generation of food companies that are purpose-driven. I mean, Megan and I think Adam are totally great examples of that. So it's really about saying, if we're going to use a new technology, why are we using it, and what is the impact there? And so to your point, those are great, tough questions that you're asking.
Well, you would have to only do it on, I mean, there would be so many things you'd have to set up, and then you would have to then wonder about the economic viability of that. I mean, you know, essentially a fish farm on land is no different than a hog CAFO or a cattle CAFO. It's just a CAFO for fish. Mm-hmm. It's not really the best, most humane way to raise a fish, obviously.
But Douglas, that's where it gets back to transparency, which I think you brought up earlier too. Like, it's a combination of understanding why people are doing what they're doing and being transparent about it so that we can make choices.
Listen, never in history have consumers been given so much responsibility to learn and educate themselves about what's being fed them. It's never happened before.
Yeah.
So it's extraordinary that this is one more foodstuff, one more category that now consumers have to educate themselves about, because it has not been tested enough for us to know the long tail of the economic and environmental impacts of introducing a species that is going to commingle with wild species.
So what about food allergies when it comes to the situation? Because, you know, if you think about, like, you know, peanuts, I have two small children, and an 8-year-old son and a 7-year-old daughter, and you can't take nuts to school. There's no nut products whatsoever, and it's not the children, it's the nuts. I was just diagnosed, I have a severe gluten intolerance last November, and finally figured out what was making me so exhausted every single day. And as soon as I stopped eating it, my entire world just sort of, I felt I had so much more energy, because my body was just being like this glycemic shock every single afternoon. And it wasn't the bread, because I had never felt like that. I mean, it wasn't me, it was the bread, right? Mm-hmm. So when these particular things happen, like, what are we doing to our own bodies that we don't really know about? Because I feel like we're being just sort of tested on as live guinea pigs, and let's just see what happens.
Well, I'm glad you brought
up. Do they really care if we get cancer? I don't think so.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up food allergies, because I think that brings up the topic of healthcare and food together and how there's such a gap in people sort of understanding what they eat and how it affects their body. And the people who are our doctors and healthcare providers, they're actually not trained deeply in nutrition or deeply in the science and eating of food. And so there really needs to be an opportunity to put the tools and the education in the hands of the healthcare people that are helping us heal, because food is such an important part of our body. And I think the food allergy one's really interesting because there's a few startups that are getting into that space, mm-hmm. where they're creating wearables for you to actually, in real time, you know, diagnose your blood sugar or understand the composition of the microbiome in your body so that you can actually have real-time feedback. There's even a startup called Six Sensor Labs that's developing a device to help you understand what's in your food, specifically for food allergies. So really bridging that gap between what we're eating, how we're feeling, and creating some new tools so that we can do that in real time with healthcare.
But there was sort of in this tough situation. I mean, like, there's, 7 billion people on the planet?
Yeah.
Like, we're going to have to start, you know, like, we're creating a pathway to Mars. Like, we're an intelligent species that will always survive. We always have, right? So we'll figure the situation out. Like, we'll desalinate ocean water and drink that, and it'll be fantastic. And we'll create food out of nothing. We'll create algae type things that grow a foot a day because it has deep nutrition, and we'll end up eating that, and some chef will make it taste delicious, right? So I think we all kind of need each other. But to me, there's so many things that when it kind of gets into, you know, like, old business models. I guess next question, and we got to keep moving quick. But this is for Adam and Douglas. Now, a study conducted by Oklahoma State University states that the average vegetable travels between 1,300 and 1,500 miles. Isn't that amazing, right? The average vegetable travels between 1,300 and 1,500 miles. And if you throw in the fact that 40% of that, what we were talking about earlier, ends up in the garbage can, is the grocery store model broken? I don't mean the service industry we talked about before, but is the model broken, and how will food travel from A to B in the future?
Well, I guess one thing to talk about is just, part of it's the distance, but the other part is the time. So when you take that typical vegetable or piece of fruit, it's taking somewhere between 7 to 10 days to the point it gets to the grocery store. It probably had multiple pit stops, and Douglas will talk more about this, even if it's local, but especially if that grocery store is far away. Well, you know, I've been to these cold storage units. They're not very inspiring, but it goes to number one. It's not a very clean cold storage unit. It goes to a second one. It goes to the grocery store. It sits in the back of the grocery store. Some point it goes to the aisle. It sits there for 4 or 5 days. So by the time it gets to your table, you know, you're at day 14 or 15. This is part of the reason why, obviously, they start doing things like modifying, you know, your different vegetables, so they can try to, like, make them last longer. But I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer, obviously, I mean, I have a stake in the game, and our bet is that going much more directly from the farm to your table is a more efficient model. Where
even if you have to put it on an airplane,
airplane, or in our case, it's ground delivery. But the key thing is the amount of time it takes from the point that the vegetable or fruit comes out of the ground to you. Right, from the moment it's out of the ground, you instantly want to start cooling off that food. You start a cold chain, and at the moment you break the cold chain, the food starts to degrade. And so you're balancing, basically. There's two things to talk about. We're talking about freshness and, like, what is a great user experience. There's also the carbon footprint. Obviously, the farther you ship it, the greater the carbon footprint. So I think there'll be a balance. I think once you look far into the future, you'll have, you know, an optimized supply chain where what you want, there'll be the best provider of that technology will identify that provider, and we'll find a way to bring it to you. In a shorter-term stance, I think you'll just find that grocery stores and companies like Sunbasket will start to figure out that we need to get your food to you a lot faster. Mm-hmm. In our case, from the ground to you is a couple days as opposed to 14 to 15 days. And so those models, I think, are shifting, like, people's perception of freshness. And so part of it's the distance, but the biggest factor is the time.
I think we start snapping all these stories together, right? I mean, there's definitely a path to real sustainability, and sometimes something will have to go by the way of the dodo to make a reality happen, right? I mean, there's so much waste when you go to the grocery store. Even if you look at the dumpsters at the grocery store, I mean, there's so much stuff that just, like, because it's not fresh or pretty necessarily. If we can cut those days down, or even more importantly, tell you what I want shipped to my house so you don't have to buy 250,000 things that I may or may not necessarily need. I think there's something really special about that model. They'll have such a powerful environmental impact that sometimes it's just like you have to pay attention to it. Okay, so I'm getting these like lovely signs here. So we're gonna if how many people have like some questions for this fabulous group of people here, right? Nice handful of people here, right? Hey, if you guys could possibly, do we have we got microphones lined up or one? We got. Point to me where the microphones are. Over in the corner? Mr. Microphone. If you guys wouldn't mind, because we're going to break from this, kind of get into some Q&As for a second. If you guys could queue up over here, and then we'll take you one at a time as soon as we do. And I'll ask a couple more questions while you guys are lining up. So this we're talking about like food distribution because like sometimes it feels like the rich people kind of get everything and the poor people get the brown stuff. But to me, like this is a question for Janet and Megan. So according to a USA Today article, the USDA, according to a USA Today article, the USDA says that 49 million Americans struggle to find enough to eat, and that's in a country that throws out 40% of everything that we have. It's a shame. What can companies do to really help this issue? And is it a company problem?
Well, I think there's a lot we can do. You know, at Williams-Sonoma, it hit me about my second year into the job that we are surrounded by food every day, and the smells, the taste, it's incredible. And I think that we're also part, in Williams-Sonoma, of one of the most generous industries I have ever been involved in, honestly. From the chefs to the vendors I work with to whether they're food or machines, it's an incredibly generous industry. More so than, again, any apparel industry, anything I've ever worked in. And it hit me that I do, have an opportunity and a responsibility to engage and help what's going on. And we found out that 1 in 5 children go to bed hungry in the United States every night. 1 in 5 in the United States every night. And so we try to figure out the best way we could to help the problem. And what we came up with was education is as big as anything. And it's not about educating the child that's hungry or the parent of the child. It's actually educating the community about how to help. And we partnered up with No Kid Hungry about 3 years ago. And they're an incredible organization that we've committed to not only raising dollars for, because that's actually not what's most important, but raising awareness for. And it's about helping educate the teachers and the administrators in the schools how to get these lunches to these children. A lot of schools have access about how to get these programs into their schools, but they're not taking advantage of it for one reason or another. So for me, it's so much about education and awareness to the right people. There's so much that you can do at a community level. And one of the beautiful things about having 248 stores, when you want to lament that brick and mortar might be something that is as an old idea, is guess what? I have 248 stores involved in 248 different communities that actually can activate something in these communities. And it's pretty powerful what we've been able to do in 3 years. And we're absolutely committed to this organization and helping these children get food to them.
And Megan, so tell me about Like the crickets again, like the idea of like inexpensive protein.
Right.
Because sometimes these are barriers, right?
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say just really quickly is part of the problem that we have in communities that are hungry is often that they're getting really low quality calories. The least expensive foods in the grocery store are ones that are high in starch and low in protein. And one of the things that is, a big driver for Bitty Foods is to take the foods that we normally eat that might be snack foods or, high carbohydrate staple foods and enrich them with high protein. So basically you can sub out that wheat flour or cornmeal or whatever and sub in cricket flour and you end up getting, suddenly your pasta has as much protein as a hamburger. And if we can bring that kind of inexpensive protein to the other areas of the plate or, to the snack foods that people are just grabbing every day, then we can do a lot to increase the nutrition and decrease the malnourishment problem.
I love that. All right, so two, two quick questions. Like, so this is up to Lauren and Janet, and I wrote this down because I'm dying to hear your thought on this, because we live in this age of like rapid change for the good, and things become cooler and things become more interesting. From a person who designs kitchens of the future, the person who sells kitchens of the future, what will the kitchen of the future look like?
So we've done a project, it's a public project with IKEA on designing the kitchen of the future. It's for 2025, and if you Google it, you can see it. And it was a great exploration and understanding what role the kitchen can play and the appliances and pieces in there in your food and in your life. And so a couple of the key things, one is definitely around waste and sustainability. So part of that design is a sink that actually allows you to divert water into two different streams so that you can reuse water that's clean or actually divert water that needs to go into the system. So there's definitely an element of that. Then there's also a fantastic tabletop that actually has built-in induction coils. It has a smart camera that's on the top, so it can actually serve as a cook surface, as a prep surface, or as a play surface. And you can imagine your kitchen actually helping you learn to cook, helping you to manage what's in your pantry. As you put food on that table, it can identify with that camera what it is and suggest recipes or suggest things. So having your kitchen really be a support system to you getting dinner on the table is one. And
it's an iPad Pro on steroids.
It is, and it's connected. I guess that's the other piece. It's actually connecting digital tools into the kitchen.
It's an iPad Pro you can cook on.
Yeah, exactly. And the last piece I think that's super interesting is this pantry that's taking your refrigerator and taking your pantry, merging it into one, and actually creating spaces on this shelf that can control the temperature to keep the foods and the ingredients that you need at the right temperature, but also out in front. So you can see what's in there, you can manage your inventory, and you can see when something's going to go bad or something needs to be used. So putting all of those things together to have a much more dynamic, guided kitchen experience. So that's the picture that we're painting right now. We're pretty excited about it.
That's a cool picture. So the actuality of what's happening, Janet. Where are things going in the near future to become the kitchen of the future? Are we into the Internet of Things yet?
Well, let's see. In my position, I'm lucky. I get to see a lot of products come in front of me that they think they're ready, you know, and then they put it in front of my team and we're like, oh, did you talk to anybody or are you just heads down on this one? You know, I'll tell you how I feel about the smart kitchen. I think what I hope is that it inspires people. What I want to believe is that the kitchen is still the heart of the home. The kitchen is not the brain of the home. It cannot turn into this tech thing that makes you dumb kitchen, right? That you don't have to think about anything. But really, it should be enhancing what happens in the kitchen, not taking things away. You know, I've seen a lot of products where people say they don't even have to think anymore, they just hit this button and it cooks. I'm like, well, people come to us because they actually want to learn how to cook. They actually want to learn how to use a whisk or how to read it if it's right in there. You know, lights and temperature control, incredibly important in the future. But we hope that of all that happens with the smart kitchen, that the heart remains in it. I've seen some incredible products coming down the pipeline. There's a lot around temperature control because truly, no one really understands. What does it mean when you put something on medium heat? Mm-hmm, right? No one really knows what that means. But the temperature control and how that actually affects what you're cooking, there's been some revolutionary ideas around. How to sell it is going to be probably the most fun challenge I really look forward to, because we have to completely change how we're selling things in Williams-Sonoma. You know, the idea of thinking that, you know, even who we hire in our stores, we today hire people who have a passion around cooking. I might have to hire people who have a passion around tech as well. You know, today our care centers help you in a different way, but what if our care centers turned into tech centers?
It's like a genius juice bar.
Right, exactly. And, you know, our online experience today is rich in stories and videos, but that's going to need to be amplified. And our mobile experiences today, kind of across the board, almost any mobile experience, just isn't good enough for where this tech is going. It needs much more storytelling and much more help. So I think it's going to be an incredible revolution. I want to encourage everybody who thinks about any smart product to use your industry. You know, my customer who's passionate about cooking, use your head who knows how to pull things from the sky. I mean, it's just what I've seen most are more, I think, going to be out-of-box failures than sure home runs in these early stages. And it's because they're kind of, you know, came from the tech industry, put their head down, designed this incredible thing, popped up, and didn't ask anyone about it.
Well, let me ask you a business question, because I think that's pretty good. Because so I'm going to give each one of you $100,000. And you have to go invest it into somebody out here in the audience who has a great food tech idea. What is it? Go ahead.
All right, so I would invest in the whole personalized nutrition. I think that's a huge frontier where you're going to be able to sort of self-diagnose what your DNA is and what your body makeup is and understand what kind of foods you need to be eating for you as a person rather than you as a statistic in a broader study. So I'm definitely placing my money.
I think there's a lot of money in blood research, to create like an automated blood nutrition analysis where you can have a full spectrum panel pulled almost on demand in a way.
Right. And ongoing, right. Not just one time.
Yeah, exactly, ongoing.
How your behavior is affecting your health.
On a monthly basis and make it cheap. Go ahead, $100,000, it's yours.
Is it my money?
It's your money. Okay. Do whatever you want.
I would split it, okay? I would put part of it into what you said, what we talked about earlier about nutrition. I think the education around personalized nutrition and what you can do to eat better and to eat more of the foods that you need to have, to, you know, as you talked about your problems with the food allergies. So educating people around those things and providing them the tools to do that, that whether it's an app or any other kind of digital appliance, I think is really powerful. The second thing is I've been really fascinated and I'm waiting to hear see what's gonna happen next, but you know, we talk about food and delivering food and getting food to places fast when people want it, but we never talk about the nutritional quality of the food, you know. The Mars rover, when it picks up a rock, it actually, that rover has sensors in it that can actually tell you what kind of minerals are actually in that rock, what the composition of it is. There are people that are working with those same devices to tell you what the composition are of foods. So I can see in 5 or 10 years from now, wands at your store where you can actually be in the produce section and buy produce based upon its nutritional value. And that's something that I would invest in.
That's cool. That's really great technology. Janet, what about you? I'll give you $100,000.
Common denominator. I would invest in something with education that teaches people how to eat, why to eat. I mean, even portion control. I just don't think we understand it still. I think that's part of the reason of all this waste, honestly.
What is that thing? So someone walks up to you, I got an idea, and it checks all your boxes. It's education.
It's probably an app that comes from an unbiased, no political motivation, just pure education. It's probably some sort of app.
well, I mean, there's been all these apps that do the quantified self. And most of them focus on the fitness point, which is really important. I mean, I run every morning, but I was 50 pounds overweight running every morning. And the change was actually when I changed my diet. And to me, all the apps that are out there right now are still too complicated.
Yep.
I mean, I went to a personal trainer before I got married, and he was showing me how to add this and how to add that. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to figure that out. And mm-hmm. So there needs to be, and I don't think anyone's cracked the code yet, a much simpler way to actually quantify the most important thing, which is what you're putting in your body. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely something that could be done. If it's from a store, it's scanning the item. If you're getting a sun basket, it's integrating our tech with a fitness app. But I think the next wave of the applications around quantified self will tie not just to the fitness element, but to the health element.
Now, are you saying there's a difference between food as fuel, purely as fuel, and then food as flavor that's just meant for enjoyment?
Well, I do believe that you have to actually have the enjoyment, and that's the fundamental premise of.
But do you have to have that every meal, like a child? You're like, it's got to be cheesy and creamy and yummy, and like, not really, right? I mean, there's food as fuel, and if we're adult enough to go, okay, this green thing tastes like green stuff,
right?
But I'm actually putting fuel into my body because my body's a machine that needs fuel,
right.
Not cream cheese necessarily, right? But I like cream cheese, but right. I'm gonna eat cream cheese when I want to eat cream cheese. But today,
right.
I'm gonna put fuel in my body because my body likes it better.
Right. Well, I guess the most important thing is I think we need to understand kind of the earlier point Lauren made of what fuel is right for each person's body. I mean, on the extreme, we have
Soylent. This is where the blood work comes in.
Right.
And
you have like the Soylent Green, right? Yeah. You have the folks that are saying, hey, like. We're going to go all the way in.
Not
and we're
Soylent Green, just Soylent.
Soylent. Okay. Soylent Green is probably a problem.
Yeah, there's no
You're
bodies
right.
in it. Yeah,
that would be a problem.
Right.
Would you
turn that into, would you turn the crickets into like a protein drink? That'd be kind of hot, right?
Kind of.
That'd be kind of hot. I'd be into that.
I know you would.
All right, I'm giving you $100,000. What are you going to invest
in? All right, I'm not talking about crickets. I think, you know, barring crickets, the other thing that I'm super obsessed with is microbiome stuff. So I would probably put that money into...
Have you had Mother Dirt? You guys made Mother Dirt, right?
No.
You guys know Mother Dirt? This MIT, cool, this MIT scientist hasn't had a shower in 22 years. But he's talking about the microbiome on his skin, because like there's actually, you know, there's more microorganisms on your skin than there are cells in your body. Mm-hmm. And super, and so we're talking about the pH balance as part of the microbiome. It's fascinating science.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What
sorry.
He said.
Yeah. But that's something you're interested in, right?
Yeah, totally.
But is that food, or is it something you're just a tech space you're
well,
you're
about? It's actually really related to your total health. Like, right. There's 10 times more organisms, something like 10 times more bugs in your gut than there are cells in the rest of your body. Mm-hmm. And they control...
And we kill those on a regular basis with antibiotics.
Yeah.
We just kill them.
Yeah, and there's all this interesting emerging research on the effects of your mental state and inflammation that causes all kinds of diseases.
And not only that, there's a lot of smart doctors, especially here in California, they're saying that the obesity epidemic is because of the over-prescription of antibiotics.
Yes, they're really related. Giving antibiotics to cattle is a way to fatten up cattle.
Right, or keep them healthy while you fatten them up, because a bovine stomach can't digest corn like that. Right. So just keep them up with antibiotics until they get to the thing. Super interesting. Guys, you guys have a good time tonight? Cool, right?
There's a question guy.
I like my friends. So, we got a question. What's your name, man?
Hi, my name's Corey.
Hi, Corey. Good?
Thank you, everybody, for coming. One of the great parts about tonight was definitely hearing from a lot of voices, talking about from the business side. I love hearing ways of creative solutions to problems we've had. IDEO, I love different IDEO methods. We use it at work all the time. But I want to open this up more to Douglas to hear a little bit more about your voice. I feel like a lot of the conversation tonight was about the future of commerce around food, maybe more to a niche market. And I think what I'd like to hear a little bit more would be your experience looking at bigger issues, maybe for people that weren't able to come tonight in terms of access to food, surpluses, talking about things like food deserts, like the Navajo Nation, that the nearest grocery store takes forever to get to. And you brought it up definitely before about problems that come in with agriculture, of sea fleas and different of the such, or agriculture looking at different GMOs. But what do you think are things that we should take from today to educate, and then also tying into your background with Lexicon of the importance of how we talk about things, not just what we talk about?
That was about 10 questions, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you, Corey. I appreciate
really,
it. Thank you.
It's great. We could definitely continue afterwards, and we can talk about it, you know, together. But I would just say really, really quickly, for me, takeaways from tonight, greater, larger issues are that we're the first generation of people that know that we now live in a world of diminishing resources. We are the first generation of people that it's incumbent upon us to actually know what it is we're eating. We can't expect the USDA or the FDA to actually look out for our best interests. So it's a tremendous amount of work that we have to do. And that work is going to come by people mobilizing, and the purchasing decisions that they make actually will shift the food system and make it more equitable for all of us.
All right, so I got one more final question, and this is I'm sorry, oh, I apologize. Hi, how are you? Go ahead.
Hi. Hey. Thanks, guys.
What's your name?
Angela.
Hello, Angela. How are you?
Hi. This is fascinating. I wish we could go on for like 10 hours tonight. I'm sure we could. But there's been a lot of discussion about how the food gets to the table, what exactly is on our plate. What is so important that I would like to hear some discussion on is reduction in our portion sizes. I think that's huge as far as waste and health. You just said briefly, you just tapped on it just now, but is there something happening, Tyler, in the restaurant industry, or I don't know, Adam, if you guys do things like that for
Well, in
basket,
the restaurant industry,
is
like,
there something happening that you know?
Well, I mean, so from a restaurant decision, you know, we're trying to economize our raw goods, so not just necessarily think through just the tenderloin, right, or like the good bits, but think through how you can really economize the entire cow. Like I always say to my cooks, and I've taken quite a few cooks to a kill, If you've ever seen a live animal being harvested, you realize, and you watch this animal lose its life for your sustenance, that the last thing you ever want to do is throw any of it out. And it's your moral obligation to make sure every bit of it tastes as delicious as possible for the soul of this animal that just lost its life, right? So we make those kind of decisions all the time by not trying to throw anything out. Like, we use everything but the oink, right? We use everything. We use the bones. We make crispy bits out of the skin. We'll make head cheese out of the head. We use the trotters. We use everything, right? We use the intestines. We'll make sausage. I mean, there's the things that we really kind of use every bit of it. But that's just on a really, really small scale, right? I mean, like with a restaurant, you're only talking about, you know, influencing 250 people a night. But with a scalable business like this, you could influence 10,000 people a week, right? And what I like about the scalability of this particular thing with portion control is because you could say, okay, boom, I'm gonna drop this meal on you, and you don't have to think about it. Like, I know I'm gonna get a healthy amount of nutrients and an appropriate amount of calories, and nothing more that I really don't want to shove in my face right now, or because I don't want to go have to work out at 5:30 in the morning tomorrow because I just ate a big donut, right? Even though that donut was delicious, right? That's what I like about this particular model. It's kind of cool. I think it's just two particular scales, but I think we all really need to think about it. But most importantly, is the waste byproduct that happens with the American grocery store. Because, like, we can't control anything about that, right? There's nothing we can do about that, because, like, the idea of having this gigantic bazaar of anything and everything you'd ever possibly want is just not sustainable. Like, to me, like, I want to tell you what I want, and if you can give him enough crowdsourced information to let him run his business, and then you get exactly what you want in the mail, everybody wins, right? And on top of that, if you can get electric trucks delivered to the stuff to take 30, 40 cars off the highway, it's the wave of the future. There's no doubt about it. Go ahead. What's your name? Last question.
Hi, my name is Zachary. Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Of course.
Fascinating conversation. Thank you. My question is about what you think the role of government plays in all of this. We've talked a lot about the private sector, but not so much about the public sector. Douglas, I'm getting the impression that you find that like the FDA and the EPA might be more antagonistic to your goals. I'm just curious about how you feel that, well, not just Douglas, but everybody, what the government will have to do to make our lives better in this sense. You know, I mean, it's the reason why beef is so cheap and McDonald's has a dollar menu, right? But I mean, like, sure. Fresh fruits and veggies are super expensive.
So there are dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico each year that are the size of New Jersey. And they're all created by nitrate runoff from agricultural operations that have water that bleeds into the Mississippi River. Those nitrates are coming from an agricultural practice that puts too much fertilizer on the ground. Farmers know that they have what's called a nutrient management problem, is what they call it euphemistically, and they won't take action unless their neighbor takes action. And it's becoming increasingly clear to people who are in a position to have a say in how agriculture works in that part of the country, that you're going to need to create regulations to enforce certain practices. So in some cases, while that we might think that's abhorrent and this is a country built upon the spirit of entrepreneurship, there are certain cases where the tragedy of the commons applies, where if we leave everyone to use a shared resource, they will use all of it until they've consumed everything and there's nothing left. So. It's a sad reality. So while I'm not personally in favor of bigger government, sometimes you do need to regulate larger industries in order to bring them into compliance.
And even if you look at it from an economic standpoint, I mean, even people who are kind of classic kind of supply-demand economists talk about market failure. Market failure is an externality, right? Mm-hmm. Where both the person on the supply side and the demand side doesn't bear the cost, and that's exactly what you're talking about. And that's where you do need regulation, is where it's actually in the commons and where there isn't sort of a market mechanism to correct.
But I think the underlying power is us, you know, as a group. We can vote with our wallet. You can grow. You can vote for things that you absolutely want, and we. I don't know what we can do to kind of get out of the harshness of a capitalist society where things are sort of kind of forced on you in a way, or you get sort of kind of corralled into some sort of decision-making thing that you may or may not want to do. But you can always have a choice to just not buy it, right? And so if enough of us make a decision, we're not going to buy stuff that we know is not good for the environment or not good for our health. It'll go away. right? I mean, it's like if the trend is transparency, if the trend is a better, cleaner food pipeline system, if the trend is sustainability as a model, then if we choose to buy that kind of stuff, it'll just materialize. So I got one more fun little question for us, and this is a tradition here with the Commonwealth Club, and that is sort of a 60-second idea that you feel will change the world, right? Lauren, I'll start with you. You got 60 seconds. Change the world.
So my dream to change the world is to actually bring in food curriculum into schools. And that curriculum should be about culinary, it should be about nutrition and science. So let's take a really holistic approach.
Yeah, it used to be called home ec. What happened to that?
No. Yeah, exactly. So
we used to actually teach people how to cook. We don't do it anymore.
But it actually didn't really deliver, I think, on what we need to do now is looking at food in that holistic lens. So not just cooking alone, but the nutrition piece and the science piece. Yeah. And that's what's going to lead to thinking around sustainability and some of these bigger challenges.
Start with the young generation.
Start
I completely
with the young
agree.
Generation.
I agree. I love that. Yeah. All right, brother.
So the Lexicon of Sustainability Project, I always tell people, is actually not meant for adults. It's actually meant for kids. We have a 9-year-old, my wife and I, who run the project together. And the thing that we're the most proud of in our project is our education program, where we actually teach kids how to look at their own food systems in their communities and to figure out what a food system is, what it looks like in their community, who's a part of it, what their sustainable practices are, and then how they can document that in a way where they can become an advocate, not only in their community, but to a larger audience, even nationally. So the thing that I always say to people is that you're responsible for your own food system. And it all begins by taking that responsibility, realizing that the food system is only going to change if you as a consumer vote every time you go to the store for the food system that you want to see.
Yep, exactly. Every dollar you spend is a vote. It really is. Janet, you're up.
Well, I think there's a relationship between our $100,000 we want to invest in our big idea. So mine would also be education and with children. I think you need to draw the line and just say it starts now with these kids. And we've got to teach them. And I don't think we should be afraid of open fire, sharp knives, and boiling water. Just put them in.
Right.
Put them in and get their hands dirty and go. And they've got to see this and feel this to understand it. And we have to start with the education and teaching. It's not about only reading. It's got to also be about doing.
I agree.
The silent killer in the United States is sugar. I believe 68% of people are overweight, 34% are obese. Sugar is one of the prime culprits. Back to education, I'm not a parent yet. I hope to be a parent soon, but I can't imagine parents in America not having the education to know that, we have all these campaigns. We spend $25 billion a year on the war on drugs. Well, we should be spending the money where it's always the message of this is like your body on drugs. Well, we should have, this is your body on sugar, right? Like, you're this bloated, giant thing. I lost 50 pounds myself, and it was diet. It was changing what I put into my body. It was not going out with my engineers and, slurping down sodas, for dinner and putting less processed carbohydrates in my body. So it will have a massive impact if, we had more education and put more resources against that.
How would you change the world?
Okay, so I think I was hearing that there's two really different sort of models for food distribution right now, and I think it's a new kind of store. So I think basically what you have is like a community hub that's like a brick and mortar space where you can have education, and you can have people come in and taste interesting foods and learn how to cook them. And
it's like Williams-Sonoma CSA,
party.
Right?
Yeah. But they don't actually buy the stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah.
They go home and they order stuff on the internet, and then driverless electric cars go to the regional distribution centers and skip all the, steps in the distribution chain and bring them right to the people's houses.
But you know how close we are to this. I mean, to be really honest with you, right?
Yeah.
We're actually really, really close to this because, if you could think through, if you could give yourself a gift of being a better parent, right, or being a better spouse, or being more attentive, or spending less time in your car, or having to go do, we spend so much time, really thinking about our food, where we're going to go get it. Now, I'm not talking about going to the farmer's market on the weekend. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, getting groceries in your house, right? And if you could make a smarter decision where you could hit a button on your phone and know everything or trust that everything is going to be organic as possible, and it kind of comes up into your house in this beautiful kit, and you open it up, and there's a beautiful recipe card, and it's got 1, 2, 3 instructions, and there's no waste in a way. Like the package could go into the compost pile, and you could have this really fabulous cooking experience. We look like a home run. We look like $1 million. I think that's something we all got to start really looking into, right? I mean, really, because you could change the world by just like. Just getting food delivered to your house, and almost it feels like stoner food in a way. Like, I just want to put my food up, my feet up, and get all my food delivered. I mean, yeah, please. Like, so my there's something here, and I hope you guys had a good time tonight, right? Because like these are my panel of colleagues. I really admire everybody on stage tonight, and I had a really great time. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you for saying yes to being part of this. Thank you. Thank you, Commonwealth Club, for doing this. And I would say that my 60-second thing to change the world is put your phone down and actually have a real conversation with somebody across the table. Yeah? That would be my thing. I had a great time tonight. Is that it? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much tonight. Will you please give a really, really wonderful round of applause for everybody up on stage tonight. Megan Miller, the co-founder of Bitty Foods. Adam Zabar, the CEO of Sunbasket. Janet Hayes, the president of Williams-Sonoma. Douglas Gayton, the eco rebel rouser, a really good friend of mine. And then Dr. Lauren Schimmick, the food scientist with IDEO Food. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you.